Welcome to the Cortana Analytics webinar. I am Ashish Bhatia. I work as a Senior Program Manager with the Cortana Analytics team. Today, we are here to unravel the secrets of data science in one of its simplest forms. And to do that, I have with me Brandon Roher. Brandon works as a Senior Data Scientist in the Cortana Analytics team. He has immense interest in writing about data science and machine learning. He's the author of numerous blogs on the Azure ML blog site, and he's also the creator of very popular Azure Machine Learning Cheat Sheet, which is one of the top 10 machine learning cheat sheets at the moment. Before handing it over to Brandon, let me quickly go over some of the bookkeeping items. This is a one-hour session. We'll do around 30 to 40 minutes of talking. It's mostly talking, no demos today. We will take up questions at the end, so feel free to put in questions at any point of time during the live session. We are recording the session, so we will send it to you later. Within like 48 hours, you will have the presentation and the recording from us. So that's pretty much it. So with that, let me hand it over to Brandon.
Hello. Welcome to Data Science for the Rest of Us. This is intended to be a gentle introduction into data science. If you have questions that I don't answer, please type them into the question entry section. And if I don't get to them this hour, I'll get to them as soon as we can. But I wrote this presentation for a special group of people. If you're wondering whether you should hire a data scientist, or you're thinking about becoming one, or if you'd like to impress your data scientist coworkers, or if you know someone that's a data scientist, this is for you. So we're not going to have any math. That's my promise to you. We're also not going to have any computer programming. But what I am going to do is let you in on the trade secrets of data science, and tell you some of the things that data scientists know and can't always explain very well. So the too long didn't read version of this is that data science isn't magic, but there are tricks and secrets. Now, as we go along, I'll be telling you some of these secrets. I'll also be telling you some of the secret keywords, some of the jargon the data scientists like to use, and it'll help you to understand and to communicate with them well. And I'll call those out on each slide as they come up. Trade secret number one, and this is a big one. If you only remember one, you can't use just any data. So if you want to make something that is spectacular, you often start with a recipe. So imagine a nice thick crispy crust with some hot marinara sauce, some melted mozzarella, some really thick pepperoni, and some fresh tomato, and you've got something really amazing. Now, if you take a few of those away, you start to lose the essence of what's there, and so it's important to have the combination. Now, in the case of data science, similarly, there are some ingredients that we need to pull together. We need data that's relevant, connected, and accurate, and enough of it. And we also need to go with that a sharp question. So I'll explain what I mean by each of these. But before I do, I want to introduce some numbers. And it's okay if this makes you a little nervous, just breathe through it. Look at the chart over on the right, underneath where it says relevant data. Now, if you look, I've just highlighted the top row. There are some numbers there. 103, that's in the column that's body mass in kilograms. And then 3 margaritas and 0.03 blood alcohol content. Now, those three numbers are all related. They all describe the same thing. They all describe one person. Because they're all connected, they are referred to as a single data point. And because they're all in a row, they're often referred to as a row. So data point and row can be used interchangeably, also sample. And then if you look at each of the individual aspects of that data point, we get our individual columns. Each column describes some characteristic, and they're called, the data science-y word for these are features or attributes, or just columns. And so when you line these up together, your rows and columns, you get a table. Nothing too fancy. But most of the time, 99% of the time, when a data scientist is talking about data, this is the picture they have in their head. A bunch of rows and a bunch of columns. And you can imagine this extended out to hundreds and thousands of columns and billions of rows, but it's still just a table. When someone talks about a database, usually it's just a table. And so now that we have this picture to work with, we can say, well, what's relevant and what is irrelevant? So if you look at body mass, margaritas consumed, and blood alcohol content, those are connected. If I tell you my body mass and I tell you how many margaritas I've had, you can make a pretty good guess at my blood alcohol content. Whereas if we look at the irrelevant data, any one of those numbers, the price of milk per gallon this week, the Red Sox batting average in their last game, and my blood alcohol content, there's no obvious relation between any of those. That's an example of irrelevant data. So relevant data is one of our ingredients in our recipe. The next one is data that's connected. So when you have a table, it's possible to have blanks, and the technical term for those are missing values. Sometimes something just didn't get written down, or it got neglected, or in the study that was conducted, that wasn't measured, and that's okay. There are ways around that. But if it happens too often, pretty soon your data starts looking like Swiss cheese, and there's more missing than there is present. In fact, if you look at the rows on the left-hand side, you can see that there's only one row that's fully populated. It has both the grill temperature and the weight of the beef patty. So because hardly any of those rows are full, it's hard to learn the relationship between those. Whereas if you look at the table on the right, that's full. That gives us a good connected data set to learn from. Now the next ingredient that we care about is accuracy. So if you look at the target in the upper right-hand corner, there's a bullseye. And you can imagine that you have been shooting arrows at that, and you're very good, and you get a tight grouping right near the center of the bullseye. That, of course, is accurate. Now, what's odd in data science speak is that the target right below that, where you have your arrows spread all around, but they're spread evenly around the center, that's also considered accurate. It's just considered imprecise. Now, if you look over on the left-hand side, you can see on the top bullseye, you see your arrows. They all landed very close together, a very precise grouping, but inaccurate. They're way off the center of the bullseye. And in the lower left-hand corner, you can see our shooting was neither accurate nor precise. So the way you can tell whether your arrow, your archery, is accurate, you can ignore the bullseye, look at where all the points fall, and then look for the middle of those. Guess where the center of that group is, and then come back and look at your target, and you can see whether the center of your arrows landed near the center of your target. If so, it's accurate. If not, then you've got problems. So our next ingredient, ingredient number four, is we have to have enough data. You can think of the rows in your table, each data point, as being a brush stroke in a painting. And if you've only got a few of them, you can't make a very detailed painting, and it can be pretty fuzzy. Now, if you do get more, then your picture starts to get a little sharper. And it starts to come into focus. And when you just barely have enough, you can just squint and tilt your head and make out what the picture is of, and then use that to make decisions. Now, when you really have enough data, that picture becomes very clear, which is even more helpful. For instance, we use this picture to make decisions. Based on this picture, if we have barely enough data, we could decide whether or not this is a place we want to visit. We can think, oh, the light looks nice, there's water, it looks clean, at least I think it does. Sure, I'll visit that. But if the picture becomes even sharper, then we can start to make finer grain decisions, like which of the three hotels on the left would we like to stay in? Well, based on the architectural features, I'll choose the one on the far left. That's not a decision that we could have made if we had just barely enough data. And the final ingredient in our data science pizza, this is the foundation. This is the crust. So we need a sharp question. So a vague question, it usually doesn't need to be answered with a name or a number. But with a sharp question, you can't avoid it. It's helpful to imagine that you found a magic lamp, rubbed it, a genie popped out, who will answer any question you ask truthfully. But this data science genie is mischievous, and it will try to give you unhelpful answers. So for instance, if you ask it, how can I increase my profits? It's a vague question, and you might get a vague answer, like work harder or put in 110%. But if you ask a very sharp question, such as which car in my fleet is going to fail first, then this genie can't help but give you the answer to the question that you're interested in and point to the car that's going to fail and give you something specific that you can do. So with a sharp question and data that's relevant, accurate, connected, and enough, then we have all of the ingredients to do some serious data science, make something really nice. So that's the first big trade secret. Trade secret number two. When you don't know what to do, turn your data into a picture. Sometimes even when you think you know what to do, turn your data into a picture. Here's an example of what I mean by that. So if you look at the right, you'll see a table. As we mentioned before, there are columns. Those are features. One is called X and one is called Y. They're numerical. There's also one labeled L. This is a categorical feature, which means it can have one of several names. So each of those data points is either an S, an L, a C, or an R. There are 1,600 of these rows. It extends well off the slide. And one of the things we want to do, another word for turning it into a picture, is visualization. And the most common way to do this is with a histogram. And I'll show you what that is in just a second. Calling out a special data science word again, class. Those categories in that third column, column L, are also called classes. They're groups that each of the data points fall into. So the first thing we can do, look at the chart on the far left. So this is taken from column X. And the way you create this chart is you go through each of your rows one by one, and you take the number and you sort them into bins. The very first bin on the left is all of the values that fall between minus 2.2 and minus 2.7. And as you go through your list, you throw them all in there, and then when you're all done, you count up how many fell in there. In this case, about 145. And you go through and do that for each of the bins, for all of your data. And when you're all done, you can look and see whether all of your bins had the same number of data points or whether there was some distribution, some pattern. Here, we see absolutely there are some interesting patterns. In our X feature, we see that some bins have twice as many data points as others. That's interesting. In the Y category, the Y column, we see that some values, the ones between minus 1.1 and minus 1.6, had five times as many values as other columns. So there's some interesting structure here. We're still not sure what it means, but we can start to see how the data is organized. Then, if we look at the third chart over on the right, we can see among the four classes, the class C class has 10 times as many values as either the L or the R classes. Again, this is interesting, but it's hard to know exactly what it means. Now, the next step is where the magic starts to happen. Here we create something called a scatter plot. I'll step through how to do that in a few minutes, but we take our X and Y values for each data point and we use them to plot a dot. When we do that, a pattern jumps out. And we see all of a sudden, instead of a list of numbers, this is a picture. It's something that our brains are wired to recognize and turn into a symbol and store and communicate with. And when we take and color code each of these dots based on the class that it belongs to, the picture gets even clearer. So here we can see now within this structure that the right eye of a smiley face is all class R, the left eye is class L, the smile is class S, and the circular head is class C. So now I just want to point out that we went from this, a list of numbers on the left, to a picture on the right. Those contain exactly the same information, but it's in a different form. In the form on the right, the picture takes advantage of the amazing pattern recognition hardware that we all have between our ears that's been wired amazingly to pull these things out and make sense of them. So turning your data into a picture might seem like magic, but it's not. Next step, trade secret number 3. So data science can only answer 5 questions. This might come as a shock if you're experience with data science is every news article you read talking about data science solving this problem or that problem. But really, there are only 5 questions it can answer, and I'm going to tell you what they are. So this short list, just 5 little things, how much or how many, the question that you answer with a number, which category, which groups does this data fall into, is this weird? And which action should I take? Now, I'll dive a little bit into each of these, but anything, just taking a short tangent, anything that answers one of these questions is called an algorithm. And it's just a recipe for taking in data, taking in a table, and spitting out an answer to one of these questions. Nothing magic about it, nothing too fancy. It's just another recipe. So, first question, how much or how many? So examples of this are, what will the temperature be next Tuesday? Or what will my fourth quarter sales in Portugal be? And algorithms, the family of algorithms that answer this question are called regression algorithms. So anytime anyone talks about linear regression or logistic regression, in the back of your mind, you can just know it's like, oh, that's just a fancy word for a recipe that spits out a number. Now the next question, the next group, is which category? So for instance, if I ask a series of questions and the answer is yes or no, true or false, A, B, C, or D. So for instance, is this an image of a cat or a dog? That's a famous problem that's performed on images gathered on the internet, given that there's lots of cats and dogs. Which aircraft is causing this radar signature? So presumably, there's a list of aircraft, which are serve as categories or classes, and the goal is to take this one data point and assign it to something on that list, one of those categories. Any algorithm, any recipe whose goal it is to answer with a class or a category is called a classification algorithm. So again, when you hear someone talking about a two-class classifier or a multi-class classifier, you can say in the back of your mind, oh, that's just a recipe for choosing which of several categories something belongs to. Question number three, which groups? So if you have a whole bunch of things, let's say I give you a whole bag full of jelly beans, and I could just ask you, well, which groups do these fall into? Sort these into groups. Now there's lots of ways you could do it. You could do it by color or by shape, or if they're different size jelly beans, you could do it by that. There's no right or wrong way to sort something into groups, but some groups just seem to make more sense to us than others. So this one is a little bit of an art. Now, recipes for doing this, algorithms for doing this, are called clustering algorithms. And you may have more experience with them than you think. If you've ever shopped online and bought a book and then gotten a message down at the bottom that said, hey, customers who bought this book also bought this blanket and this type of camera, that is probably using some type of clustering algorithm. It looks at all of the shoppers on that online website, and it looks at groups of shoppers that tend to buy the same things. And so if there's a bunch of shoppers who all buy the book that you just bought and that blanket and that camera, then once you buy that book, you can say, oh, you might belong to this group. Here are some other things that people in this group have bought, and it'll recommend to you. And based on your experience, you probably have a sense that those are not perfect, but sometimes they're pretty good. The same thing can happen if you're watching video content online and you watch several videos and then the program will recommend to you, you might also like this video, all based on a clustering algorithm. So, is this weird? Now, this seems like an unusual question to be asking about data, but again, this is something that you may have more experience with than you think. When something is weird, especially when you're seeing millions of them a day, it can mean that there's a problem. So for instance, in a car, there's a whole bunch of sensors, everything is sensed, including tire pressure in a lot of cars. And so if ever you see something unusual, that might mean, if you see an unusual pressure reading, it might mean the tire is low or high or something's damaged. This is useful in security. If internet activity is unusual, it can suggest that someone's doing something nefarious. If a credit card company is looking at your purchase history and sees that you buy gas at the same gas station every week and milk at the same grocery store every week, and then all of a sudden it sees you paying for a taxi cab in Bhutan and buying plane tickets in Paris, then a flag goes up because it's also running an algorithm looking for weird data points. And it says, hey, this is weird. It might be fraud. And so it can check that out. Now, recipes for doing this answering this type of question are called anomaly detection. And they are everywhere and very helpful. Finally, this is one of my favorites. Which action should I take? Now, there are systems like, say, a thermostat or a security system or a robot that vacuums your carpet that has to make decisions about what it should do on a regular basis. It's not working with a pile of data that is fixed and just sits there. It is working with a flow of data that's changing. And most importantly, if I'm, for instance, a vacuum cleaning robot, if I go to the next room, my whole world just changed. So now all of the decisions that I make are different. And so I need an algorithm or a recipe for making those decisions that takes into account what I'm experiencing right now and not a big average of everything I've experienced over my whole lifetime. So if there's a self-driving car, it has to constantly make decisions like, should I brake or accelerate in response to that yellow light? And one algorithm for making these type of decisions, one family of algorithms, is called reinforcement learning. And it's based on models of how animals and humans learn based on reward and punishment. So those are the five questions. Now, the algorithms for answering those five questions are all examples of machine learning. Machine learning is often talked about as if it were mysterious or supernatural or just unfathomable to mortal people. And I want to make the case that machine learning is simple. So please bear with me just a few minutes, and I'll see if I can't convince you of that. Машинное обучение не действительно сложное, но оно иностранный язык. Machine learning isn't actually complicated, but it is a foreign language. Now, with any foreign language, when you get an earful of it, all of a sudden, it can be overwhelming and meaningless and a little bit off-putting. But if you break it down, it is something that is actually learnable. It's not that complicated. So here is an approximate word-for-word translation of that sentence into Russian. It's still a lot to take in, but we can break it down to finer and finer pieces. We can look word by word. Still an unfamiliar collection of symbols. We can look at it phonetically. Still an unfamiliar collection of sounds. We can break it down letter by letter. And still an unfamiliar collection of symbols and sounds, even when it's broken down. But broken down to its simplest piece, we can say, oh, you know what? That backwards R in Russian makes the sound ya. Like, great. That is an accurate fact. That is a piece of the Russian language. It's a very small piece, but all of the pieces are very small, and they're all learnable, and you can add them up together to learn the entire thing, as well as anyone. It just takes a lot of persistence to do so. So at its base, it is simple. Machine learning is the same way. So to illustrate that, we're going to talk about diamonds. So I decide I want to shop for a diamond. I walk into a jewelry store. I have a notepad and a pen, and I write down the price of all of the diamonds that I see and how much they weigh in carats. So I start with the first diamond, and I write down 1.01 carat at a price of $7,366 and so forth, and I move all the way down through the list of all the diamonds in the store. Now, what started as an impromptu list, if you look at it, we actually have two columns. Each column is a different attribute of the thing that we're recording, the diamonds, and each row corresponds to a single diamond. So we've actually created here a little data set, a table. And I want to point out that it is relevant. Carats are related to price. It's accurate. We wrote down the numbers exactly as we saw them. It's connected. There's no blank spaces, no missing values. And it's, we'll see in a minute, it's barely enough. So the one thing we're missing is a sharp question. And so we ask a sharp question. I want to buy a diamond that is 1.35 carats. How much will that cost me? Now, the obvious thing would be to look down the list of carats and see if there's one that's 1.35, but there's not. There's some that are close, but nothing exactly. So, okay, let's use the data as a whole to answer that. So the very first thing we do is we make a number line, which is exactly what it sounds like. We draw a line, we put evenly spaced ticks on it, and we write numbers on it. Here, we look at our carats, and they vary between 0 and 2, so we number our line between 0 and 2. Now, the fancy word for this is an axis, but really, it's just a number line. Now, we pull a trick, and we draw another number line that's vertical instead of horizontal and connect it to the first one. We make another axis, this time for the price in dollars. And the units of each axis are the things that that number line is counting. So on our horizontal axis, it's in units of carats. Our vertical axis is in units of dollars. Fancy words for simple ideas. Now we're going to take this data and turn it into a scatter plot. I told you we were going to step through how to do this. The very first thing we do is we look at our first diamond. We look at the weight, 1.01. We go down to our number line and we eyeball a vertical line at 1.01. Then for that same diamond, we look at the price, 7,366. And we go down to our price axis and we eyeball a horizontal line at 7,366. And if it's helpful, you don't even have to eyeball. You can draw these lines yourself. Now, right where those lines cross is the intersection of that is a point that represents that data point. So we put a dot there. That dot represents the first diamond. And we can go through and do this for all of the diamonds in the data set. When we do, this is what we get. We get a bunch of dots. And we look at that, the first thing it looks like is, oh, there's a bunch of dots. But if you look at it and you squint and you tilt your head, we can start to do that magic that we saw before where you turn it into a picture. And you can say, you know what? That kind of looks like a fat, fuzzy line. And so we take our magic marker and we draw a straight line right through it. Now, what we just did is very significant, but I just want to take a minute to call that out. When we go from just the dots that we drew, which that's just copying the information from one source to another, to drawing a line, what we've done is created a model. You can think of it as taking the real world and making a really simplistic cartoon version of it. Now, the cartoon version is wrong. Models are always wrong. You can see that line doesn't go through all those data points. And just like a cartoon version of your portrait does not look like you, it doesn't have all of the detail of your hair and your freckles, but it's useful. It's a useful simplification. So here, that line is a useful simplification. Now, the fact that those dots don't lie right on that line is okay. And often the way data scientists talk about that is they say, well, there's the model, which is the line, and then each of those dots have some noise or some variance associated with them. So, you know, there's the underlying platonic perfect relationship, and then there's the gritty reality of the real world that puts noise and jitter and uncertainty into things. Now, because we're trying to answer a question of how much, we want to know how much a 1.35 carat diamond will cost, we know that we're going to be using a regression algorithm. In this particular case, we're drawing a straight line. There's a special word for that. That's a linear regression. So there's a technical word for, again, a simple idea. Now that we have our model, we just have to use it. We have to ask it a question. And the way we do that is we want to say, how much will our 1.35 carat diamond cost? So we eyeball a vertical line that starts at 1.35 and goes up and intersects that line. Then from right where those cross, we eyeball a horizontal line over to the vertical axis, and we look at where it hits. And it hits right about exactly at 8,000. Boom, that's the answer. The answer to our question is, if I want to buy a 1.35 carat diamond, I can expect it to cost about $8,000. That's a prediction. So we ran our recipe, we got the answer. The prediction, the answer is $8,000. Now you can be forgiven for questioning the precision of that answer. I mean, you see all the dots there. Lots of them lie nowhere close to the line. So you can say, well, maybe the actual price I pay is not going to be right at 8,000, but it'll be in the neighborhood of 8,000. And that's a great observation. And we can handle that too. The way we do is we go back and we draw another fat line, like an envelope around the first line. This envelope captures all of our other data points. And we say, this is our confidence interval. We're pretty confident that everything that we measure is going to fall right within this line. Now, what we can do is, again, look at our 1.35 carat line and eyeball right where it crosses both sides of that envelope, project that back over approximately, project that back over to the y-axis, the vertical axis there, and see where it crosses. And now we can say with a little more confidence, I believe that the diamond's going to cost about $8,000, but it might be as low as $6,800, and it might be as high as $10,200. But it will almost certainly be somewhere in between. So this region that we've put around the price of the diamond is also called a confidence interval. So we have an answer to our question. So congratulations. Now, I want to take a second and step back and point out what we just did. So we built a machine learning model from scratch. We used linear regression as the model that was under it, and we made a prediction complete with a confidence interval. This is what data scientists get paid for. This is their job, and we just did it on PowerPoint, and we didn't need any math or any computers to do it. So, congratulations, feel good, pat yourselves on your back. Now, I do want to point out that if we had included more information, such as the cut of the diamond, added another column for that, the color of the diamond, how close it was to being white versus yellow, the number and size of inclusions in the diamond, we could add more columns to our data. Once you have more than two columns, it gets challenging to draw it with a pen and paper. And it gets doubly challenging to try to find the straight line or curvy line that goes right through it. At that point, it gets really helpful to have math. So I will say that you got to know math to really get into it. The other thing is that if instead of 15 diamonds, we had 15,000 or 15 million diamonds, then again, everything we did to do by hand would take too long to do practically. That's where computers come in. So to really do this and do it well, you do need math and computers. I will grant you that. But don't be scared. You have learned that a backwards R means yaw, and you have learned how to create a linear regression model. These are pieces of knowledge and experience that are real, and now when you talk with a data scientist, you have a little bit clearer picture of what it is that's going on. So good job. Trade secret number five, there's lots of right ways to do this. So once you identify the family of machine learning algorithm that you need, there's several individual examples, actually many individual examples, members of that family. And sometimes, often some have advantages over others, but sometimes it doesn't matter too much which one you use. So to give you an example, you're sitting in a meeting, you're across the table from a data scientist, and the data scientist says, I have a large data set of people who have visited our website, and I want to be able to predict who will return and who will not. So a standard churn prediction problem. And so you can look at this flow chart sitting in your lap, and you say, okay, so I'm predicting categories, will return, won't return. Good. And there's only two of these categories. So I know I am looking at a two-class classification algorithm. Now, the data scientist continues and he says, this is something that we're going to have to do often, so we need something that is fast to compute, and we have a very large data set. So fast training is an important attribute of what we choose. And looking at this cheat sheet, we see that there are a number of two-class classification algorithms that offer fast training. Now, if you wanted to impress your data scientist, you could choose a couple of these and say, well, I know that two-class logistic regression offers fast training, but it's limited to linear models. So if we really want the highest accuracy, maybe we should go with a two-class boosted decision tree and impress the socks off of your data scientist. But this is actually a similar process to what data scientists go through in their head. So a secret is that a data scientist actually never knows which of these is going to work the best. There's often, based on their experience, they have a pretty good guess, but the only way to be certain is to try them all if it really, really matters. So usually a pretty good guess for most purposes is adequate. Now I want to point out that the machine learning algorithms listed here are all available through an online machine learning environment called Azure Machine Learning, which all of you are invited and welcome to try for free. There are links to it that will be at the end of this presentation, and it's an opportunity to take and play with these and get to know them. Now, the very final trade secret of data science is, again, related to the online resources available. You can make other people do your work for you. Microsoft has also something called the Cortana Analytics Gallery, and it contains several varieties of resources. One of these is Azure Machine Learning experiments or models that people have built. So if you go to the homepage, again, everyone is welcome, and you click on experiments, you get several experiments and the opportunity to search for many more. And you can say, you know what, I know I'm trying to do a clustering problem, and I see on the left-hand side, oh, look, someone else did some work on clustering. I click on that, and I open up a web page describing the work that they did, showing some results. And then there is a link that says Open in Studio. So I can click on that, and it takes me right to Azure Machine Learning Studio, where I have my very own copy of the experiment that they created with their data set and all of the processing they did and all of the algorithms that they used and how they saved the results. And now I have a starting point. I can take and swap my data out for the data they used. And granted, I'll probably have to make several other changes to try to make it work smoothly, but this really gives me a running start, and it allows me to build on the carefully thought through work that other people have done. There's also other content in the Cortana Analytics Gallery that is specifically how-to for people new to the field. For instance, there is an experiment there that illustrates how to handle missing values. So when your data does look like missed Swiss cheese, there are lots of ways to fill in those holes. You can make guesses about what should be there and then make your data more connected so that it's more usable and able to give you better results. And this particular experiment walks you through 15 different ways of substituting these empty values and the benefits of each and when to use them. So just as an example. So there you are, the secrets of data science. The goal is to make these the worst kept secrets and to share them with you and anyone else who will listen, just to make it easier to get the answers that you want out of your data. Quick recap, you can't use just any data. Turn your data into a picture to understand it. Data science can only answer 5 questions. It's simple at its core. There's lots of right ways to do it, And you can make other people do your work for you. Now, everything that I talked about, the examples that I used, there are links to them. They're in the window that you look at on the Resources tab. I would welcome a continued conversation with you. So please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn or on Twitter or to email me directly. And I will, with the remainder of the time, answer a few questions. But I'd like to encourage you, if you've found this helpful at all, this content, this presentation will be available online for a while, and share it with coworkers or with friends who you think it might help. So I'd like to give a special thanks to Diane Rohr for the image and layout design she contributed to there. So I see that there's 12 minutes left in the hour. I am looking at the question tab here, and I'm going to start. There are a few. I'll go back to one from Mark Frawley at 138. Question is, so much of data science appears to conflate correlation and causation. How does one validate that a relationship is not mere correlation? Is there an argument that correlation is enough oftentimes? Ooh, so this is a fantastic question. It's at the philosophical core of data science. And more important, it's at the practical foundation. And it really depends what you want to do with it. So there's a couple of things you can do with data science. One is you can look back on what's happened and tell a story about it. So, for instance, it's coming close to the end of fall here in New England, where I'm based. And in fall, two things happen. The leaves turn yellow and the temperatures get low. Now, based on the data that I've collected, both of those things happen at the same time. They're correlated. So that's a fine story to tell. As I look back, both of these things happen together. Now, causation is making the jump to assume that, say, because the leaves turn yellow, the temperature goes down. That's not supported by the data that I have already. In order to determine that, I would have to design an experiment. So the way that we try to control for that in data science is there's two things that we do. One is, when you're training a model, you hold aside some data. So you have some data that you train your model on, and then a separate set that you test it on. So you try to learn from one and then check your learning on the other. You can imagine that if you learn on one and then check your learning on that same, it's like overstudying for a test. You can learn a certain set of facts really well, but you don't really learn the rest of the subject. So by having a training and a test set, it lets you do both. This is a deep question that I won't be able to cover entirely here. I've scratched the surface, and I strongly encourage you to keep digging in. Next question, asked at 140 by Reed Lee. The question is a confidence interval the same thing being referred to when you hear polling that says accurate within a margin of error of plus or minus 3%? And the short answer is yes. The mathematical details are subtle in how people calculate that, and they might mean slightly different things. But yeah, that's what that means. If you say that someone has is polling, for instance, in the presidential races of 48% plus or minus 3%, and someone else is at 47% plus or minus 3%, the difference between 48 and 47 is smaller than the differences covered by their confidence intervals. So you actually don't know who's ahead, even though one number is higher than the other. Bob Savard, sorry if I am butchering the pronunciation there. Question is, why doesn't the confidence interval vertically intersect the edges of the blue area? So that was just an issue in the rendering on the screen. In theory, it should have. Good observation. Dhruv Sakali asks, will Azure ML also include some deep learning methods, or can it take advantage of these via Python and CUDNN, which I believe is CUDA with deep neural networks? So don't take my answer as authoritative here, because I'm not aware of the latest. I know that there's a lot of work around this area, but I know that there are opportunities. You know what? I am going to backtrack, and I'm going to refer you to Azure Machine Learning there, to the website itself, because I actually don't remember the current state right now. But I'll just say that it's a really good question and definitely deserves looking into. From a source more authoritative than me. Stacy Jones asks, is it always apparent when data is relevant or not? I.e., weather likely impacts package delivery, but what about the Redskins rule? So this is another great question. It goes back to correlation. I don't know the Redskins rule, but I'm going to guess, I've seen some similar things that looks at data historically and might see something like the win-loss record of the Redskins and correlate it to delivery time for packages. And the correlation is surprisingly tight. So all that means is that if you look at enough different random things, you'll see a few of them happen to jiggle in the same direction at the same time and correlate nicely. It doesn't necessarily mean that one causes the other. It doesn't necessarily mean that leaves turning yellow causes people to start playing basketball, for instance. But it is the deeper question is, I claimed that relevant data was an important part of our data quality, one of our recipe elements, one of our ingredients for good data science. But what if we don't know what's relevant and what's not? Fantastic question. Often we don't. And sometimes that's one thing that we learn from machine learning, is we put some things in there that might be relevant, and then we see based on the results whether it is or not. Now the trap, that's okay to do, that's perfectly okay. The trap to avoid is to blindly lump a bunch of data together without thinking about what it means or where it comes from, and expect that we can learn something, the original example. We can learn blood alcohol content from the price of milk and the Red Sox batting average. If we think about the problem first and go out of our way to measure the things that we think matter, that we think are relevant, that will get us a long way toward getting a good answer. We may, along the line, end up learning that Red Sox win-loss record actually impacts it as well. But that would be subject of a deeper research effort. Another question from Bob Savard. If a software developer who's good at hacking wants to become a data scientist, what would be the recommended path of study, education, experience? Step one, listen to this webinar. Step two, go to the resources links at the end and start to explore those. Step three, it starts to get a little fuzzy. I will say that if there are some excellent online resources and forums, such as DataTao, KD Nuggets, and there's some very smarter people than me have actually taken a very good shot at answering this very question. Data science is big. It's like asking, how do I learn sports? The first thing you want to do is poke around a little bit and actually figure out like what parts you'd like to focus on the most. But jump right in is the answer. And you can do a lot of it from your desk. So strongly encourage that. Antoine Cossoul. Question is, how would you explain to a non-data scientist the difference between statistics, which data scientists have been using for years, and machine learning, which sounds kind of new? Good question. A lot of these terms are pretty fuzzy, and if you try to draw a sharp line between them, you can trip yourself up pretty quickly. Taking a shot at this off the top of my head, I believe that machine learning is a recipe, like I said, it's for getting an answer. A recipe that uses statistics as one of its ingredients, or to extend the metaphor, as one of the tools that you use to blend your ingredients together. They're not separate things, but their statistics is the rules and the foundations of understanding and the analysis techniques. And machine learning is more the hey, what steps do I need to take to get a number that answers this question? Question from Rudmila Raman. Can you provide some examples of how machine learning is being used by data scientists in financial services, specifically capital markets, investment banking, and or corporate lending? Oh, so I can tell you that it is. I mentioned the example of fraud detection in credit cards. That's a big one. A similar one is often banks have to decide how much money should I lend this individual. So they have to decide based on their credit rating and other information whether how likely they are to pay it back. Or even what is their credit rating? Again, something that can be learned or refined based on data. And I'm sure that there are many, many others. This isn't an area that I've spent a lot of time with. I have some colleagues who have, but unfortunately, they're not on the call right now. Again, I'd encourage a quick Google. It'll probably be able to tell you, or sorry, a quick Bing search of that. It'll probably be able to tell you much more information than I could. Question from Shah Rukh. How important R language plays role in creating model? If you spent any time at all reading about data science, you've probably read about the R language. So in our recipe metaphor, R is one of the tools that you can use to combine your ingredients. It is a language. You know, sometimes you want to use a marker and a clipboard. More often, the R language will work for you. Python will. Some things you can do in Microsoft Excel or any other full-featured computer language. R is a language that was specifically designed by statisticians for doing statistics and things like machine learning. So it's well suited to some things. And again, there are great conversations in forums online about which tool is best for exactly which task. So I see that we're getting very close to the end of the hour now. And I just wanted to close by thanking you all very much for listening. If I didn't get a chance to answer your question, please, on LinkedIn, Twitter, or email, feel free to pose it to me there. And I would love to follow up with you and connect with you there. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brendan. Thanks for a great session. As Brendan mentioned, a lot of links and resources are available to you on the right side in the resource window, so double-click on them. It will lead you to the cheat sheet and some of the blogs that Brendan has already written. Also, what I wanted to state was this was the last webinar for the year before the holiday season to this webinar series, so we'll pause this learning thread with this webinar, and we will restart again next year with some more interesting topics. Okay, send us your feedback. Please take the survey. Let us know what you feel about this learning series and what we should include in the coming year. And thanks again for listening. Stay tuned, and we will be back next year. Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.